On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A rising tide lifts all boats, President John F. Kennedy famously said. But for the last 30 years in the U.S. economy, that has not been true. In 1970, the average American in the bottom 90% of income made the equivalent of about $27,000. By 2002, after years of work and sweat and rising productivity, that number for the bottom 90% had actually fallen. While incomes for the top 10th had nearly doubled, and the tip-top had soared into the billions, the top 28,000 Americans earned more than the bottom 96 million combined. The tide lifted the yachts, and that tide is still running. Up next on Point, we're looking for good answers, for real solutions to America's surging inequality. We're going to hear a lot of voices in this hour, from the grassroots to Nobel Prize winners, lots of ideas. On Point news analyst Jack Beatty is here to join us in the hunt for answers. Jack, thanks for being with us. After what you've heard this week, how are you looking at the hunt for solutions?
Well, you know, we've heard a lot and a rich discussion. One thing we haven't heard about is partisan politics. How has inequality fared under Republican and Democratic presidents in the post-war era? Larry Bartels at Princeton has worked it out in an important paper. He finds that even families in the 95th percentile, same performance for Democrats and Republicans in terms of income growth. But he finds that families at the 20th percentile, more than four times greater income growth under Democrats than under Republicans. This is because Democrats have outperformed Republicans by 30% on average on unemployment and by 30% on average on GDP growth. And from this, he concludes, surprisingly to me, that income inequality would have declined slightly over the last 30 years had the patterns of income growth actually observed during Democratic administrations been in effect throughout that time. Conversely, if the application of patterns of income growth observed during periods of Republican control had maintained and stayed throughout the last 30 years, we would have had an even greater divergence of economic fortunes, including in the 80-20 income ratio. That would have been about 80%, would have gone up 80% faster than it actually did.
Maybe it's as simple as the ballot box. I don't know. I'm looking at Senator John McCain. He says elections in the U.S. today are nothing less than an influence peddling scheme in which both parties compete to stay in office by selling the country to the highest bidder. And if you want to look at it from a more left point of view, Robert Kuttner says we cannot fully blame this change on one political faction or party. Too often over the past 25 years, both parties have been drinking the same Kool-Aid. We're going to hear a lot of answers today, Jack, and I'm delighted to have you with us. I want to jump right in with David K. Johnston. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times, known for his tough reporting on how American tax policy really works. David K. Johnston, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Tom.
You say that the description of America's tax system might be described as Robin Hood in reverse, robbing the poor and middle class to give tax cuts to the rich. Is there a problem here that plays out into overall inequality, and where do you see answers, David?
Well, absolutely this plays into overall inequality. We now have a tax system in which those people who make $100,000 to $200,000 a year pay a larger share of their income to the federal government in all federal taxes than people who make more than $10 million. And in income taxes alone, people who make a half a million, that's a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
but those people pay a larger share of their income to the federal government than those people who make more than $100 million a year.
So there's a kind of idea out there that this inequality is almost just a natural growth, kind of the hand of God or destiny or fate.
Right.
Are you saying that it is deliberate government policy, or it is, if not deliberate, then is in effect of tax policy, in part at least, that this has occurred?
Well, it isn't just tax policy. Look, government at all levels is one-third of the American economy. Government sets the rules. So when government says, for example, that it's much more difficult to organize workers into unions so that they can bargain for higher wages, it is making decisions about who will benefit and who will not. When government changes the rules on who is eligible for retirement or the funding of pension plans. And, you know, when you get hired by a company, if it has a pension plan, you're giving up part of your wages today for your retirement. But if the company doesn't put that money into your plan, it's in effect stealing from you. Yet the government doesn't treat this as a criminal matter. And so there's been rampant stealing going on, and that's why you see these shortfalls in these pension funds. The government plays a major role, Tom, in the distribution of incomes by the rules that are set by the government.
Warren Buffett, the great investor, super rich, super savvy investor, says, if there was a class war, my class won. What's your answer? What's your solution, David?
Well, I think fundamentally we need to talk about the government's rule book, and we need to be examining how these rules are affecting the distribution of income. One of the most salient important points to remember is that the huge growth is going on in the top 0.1%. In 2003, that's the last year we have data for, 25% of all the income growth in America went to the top 0.1% of Americans, and nobody except the top half of 1% did better than the rate of inflation. That is, everybody was worse off or even as a class, except the top half of 1%. And even within that group, all the gains went to the very, very top.
So in your area of expertise, what would you suggest for helping turn that around or at least slow it down?
Well, first of all, you can't think about taxes without thinking about spending. I mean, we need to think about how much government we want and what we want to spend government money on. Secondly, I think we need to fundamentally look at the and re-examine the entire tax system, including, and there are a number of people, liberals I'm finding, who are now starting to talk about, should we, for example, eliminate the corporate income tax because it's not effective and have everything flow through to the owners of that tax, or should we consider getting off the income tax altogether? I mean, fascinatingly, Forbes magazine, of all places, suggested the other day that we consider a carbon tax because that would be a measure, the amount of carbon you consume, of your well-being.
And if we did those, let's just say those two things, do you expect a change in the level of inequality? Is that enough?
Not in and of itself. I think we have to address fundamental issues like rates of pay, rules about health care. One of the things that's hurting people's incomes in this country is the way we've decided to finance health care. So that we have large numbers of people who don't get health care. They are much more likely to be disabled, to be unable to work because of something that with proper health care would not be a lifelong disability. And we don't have income maintenance programs. We have a system now with a lot of risk. You can lose your job because of changes in the economy in a way that wasn't true in the 50s and 60s, and yet we haven't adjusted our mechanisms to recognize that as other countries have.
So look to the structure. Don't ignore the taxes because they play a real part here. And look, and not least, at our very health. David, we've got a lot of people to talk to today. We're grateful for your time. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize winner at the New York Times. Joining me now from Chicago, James Heckman, professor of economics at the University of Chicago, winner of the 2000 Nobel Prize in Economics. Professor Heckman, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
We've heard about so many causes for inequality, globalization and technology and gaps in education, government policy at some level, maybe just plunder in CEO pay and the furor over how stock options are distributed recently. What's your answer to this, Professor Heckman?
Well, you raise a number of questions, and I think if we took a few hours, I could probably start to answer some of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the principal concern that's occupied most people's attention has not been so much total inequality, overall inequality, so much as inequality in the labor market, the unemployment experienced by less educated people, the growing wage gap between those people who are educated and those who are less educated. And so I think if we're going to start looking at that question and just bite off this one piece at a time, we'll make a couple of observations. First of all, there's a trend that's true around the world about growing skill gaps between the rich, now the highly educated, I should say, and the poor. That is a phenomenon that is not a consequence of a particular tax system or particular policy in one country or another, except, and the exception is, countries that have tried actively to encourage people to participate in education have been able to slow down the rate of growth of inequality.
How's the United States doing on that front?
It is doing less well than other countries. And I think this is linked very much so to the structure of families and to the structure also of our educational policy.
So are you pointing then really at the bottom of the income chain? I mean, what about the middle class? We've seen a lot of stagnation there as well, have we not?
No, but what I'm saying is that the largest gains have accrued, again, in terms of earnings, not in terms of overall wages, and capital gains income, but just earning, just labor market payment, have come between those who are college educated and those who are not college educated.
So if we're looking for answers,
the largest drop-off at the, mm-hmm. among the high school dropout groups.
Mm-hmm. Are you saying then, kids study harder, and families, keep the lights on later for homework at night? Or what's the kind of national solution embedded in that observation?
Well, I think what we need to understand is that a big contributor to all of this is the decline in the American family. That essentially, if you look at some of the basic statistics about the fraction of successive cohorts of Americans who are going to college, we see a stagnation. It's a stagnation at a time when the return, the economic return to getting a college degree has gone up. The percentage of people within recent cohorts, recent birth cohorts going to college has not much changed in the past 30 years.
Are you then saying to those who have not been on the gaining side of this, it's your own fault? You haven't gone to enough school?
Well, you have to ask why people aren't going to school. I don't want to assign blame. I think we can start asking, well, what are the major determinants of who goes to school, who goes to college? And there we look more deeply at family structure. We look at the fact that individuals who come from advantaged families are able to get the abilities, the motivations, and the skills that make them successful in school and in life. Those individuals who come from disadvantaged families, those individuals who come from single-parent families, especially parents where the mother may have only a few years of education, may herself be a teenager and the like, those kids are growing up with enormous disadvantages, and a greater fraction of the American workforce in the future will be coming from those disadvantaged families.
James Heckman, professor of economics at the University of Chicago, winner of the 2000 Nobel Prize in Economics. Professor Heckman, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Russ is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Russ, you're on the air.
Hi, well, thank you very much. A couple of comments,
yeah.
If I may. This growing gap, I think, you cited a number of statistics. I'll give you a couple of other ones that appeared in our local paper here. One was something that came out of the Economic Policy Institute, which said that CEOs earn 262 times more than an average worker does. And then an article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal just a day before that said that, well, you know, average workers have been bashed in their pensions, that the executives' pensions have flourished.
So what do we need, Russ? What's the answer?
It strikes me from listening to the programs over the course of the last week that, we have this concept of a market economy. And what strikes me is that it's not only used to explain the irrational the growing inequality. It's actually used to drive it, make it deeper. For example, when the chairman of the Delphi Corporation was talking about the situation with his company, he said, we have two markets, one for executive labor, the other for manufacturing labor. And he used that to explain why those executives were being given large bonuses and workers were being asked to take cut in their, whether it was pensions or wages or, you know, or benefits.
Give us your answer, Russ. We're driving straight for those today.
Okay, I think we ought to strengthen the labor movement in this country because it helped to build an American middle class that is basically being destroyed. And I think the other thing with respect to this concept of the market, I think that's ideological, and I think that, you know, that it's the proponents of the market society as the be-all and end-all to resolving all of our problems. I don't have an answer how you start to do that, but I am struck by how this seems to be a replay of the Gilded Age and of the 1890s and the early 1900s.
So let's open up our minds and look around. We'll do that. And you point to labor. Let's look at that front. We're joined right now from Atlanta, Georgia, by Anna Berger. She is Secretary Treasurer of the Service Employees International Union, a giant one. She's been called the most influential woman in the U.S. labor movement. Anna Berger, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Thomas. Great to be with you.
We've been looking all week at inequality in America. Our caller, Russ, says to change it, we've got to bring back labor and unions. Will that work? Is that the way?
I absolutely agree with Russ. I mean, as you said, the economic divide is greater than at any time in our history. And CEOs and corporations are just thinking about themselves only, and it seems like that you can see no end to greed. You know, their salaries keep on escalating, their profits keep on escalating, and workers keep on being left further and further behind.
But so have unions been left further and further behind. So can we look to that as a solution today, or is that history?
That's absolutely. Our Change to Win Federation, which is seven unions that have come together about organizing workers again, believe that the way to do this is to organize workers, to unite them so that we can have a voice again in our country and in our jobs. If you think back to the 50s, when I was growing up, When one in three workers was in a union, we had the power to lift up whole families, whole industries, whole communities, whole generations. It really did mean that with a union job, that you could raise a family, buy your own home, have health care, a pension, and send your kids to college. You meant, like, for kids like me, I had a chance to go to college and have a better life for my family.
You know, the argument that is put up against that today is, hey, we have a globalized economy. You can't build an island for yourself in that economy without being economically uncompetitive. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that if with a stronger union voice, we would have stronger policies about how do we take care of not just corporations but workers as we globalize. If you think back to all of the trade laws in our country, it's about trade that's good for corporations and leave the workers behind. It's not about our environment. It's not about labor here or anywhere else. We could change something about that. The truth also is, however, that there are 50 million jobs, 50 million of them in the service sector, jobs that aren't going to be offshored, jobs that can't be done anywhere else. They are jobs that need to be done in our communities, in our country, and can't be offshored. You can't move the truck driver to a different country to get the goods delivered from the ports to the middle parts of our country. So they're real jobs, and we believe that we can raise up their salaries. In the 50s, person working on an assembly line, turning one bolt after another bolt, mm-hmm. didn't have an inherently valuable job. He had a job that was valued because he had a strong union. The truck drivers who were driving from the ports, people who were stocking shelves, picking crops, people who are cleaning our hotels, serving food in our school cafeterias, taking care of our communities, helping us raise our kids, are all doing valuable jobs. It's just not valued by their employers.
What about technology, Anna Berger? Is technology up against you here? That worker turned that bolt on the assembly line today. A robot may do it. Is technology inevitably going to push these wages down, even if you get stronger unionization?
The world is always going to change. Technology is always going to be out there. We need to figure out how to, as the jobs change, how to value the new jobs in our new economy and not just leave the workers behind. Many people came to our country, including my grandparents, who believed that they wanted to have a better life. And we believed in the American dream. You worked hard, you played by the rules, you could have a better life for yourself and your kids. The truth is, we are at risk of turning over to the next generation a worse life than our generation had.
Let me take a call from East Lansing, Michigan, if I may. Molly's on the line there. Molly, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a student, a working student at Michigan State University, and I just think it's outrageous how the Bush administration, or Bush himself, freely admits he serves the wealthiest 1% at his fundraising dinners. And so I think it's no wonder the tax policy benefits that group.
But Molly, this trend has been going on long before George W. Bush got to the White House. How do you think we address it?
Well, I don't really know how we address it. I think the attitude needs to change that. I think the rich don't work harder necessarily. I think they just work smarter and they have more and better connections. I think they happen to be at the right place at the right time in a lot of situations. And I think this attitude that people who are poor choose to be poor because they don't work hard is outrageous. I think poor people many times work much harder than the rich. They just don't have the right connections. They're not in the right place at the right time.
Molly, thanks very much for your call. Anna Berger, you heard Professor Heckman say earlier, this is the Nobel Prize winner from University of Chicago, you've got to have better education and better family structure. And kind of implicit in that is, you know, if you're not making out well in this economy, get your act together, you know, hold your marriage together, have a two-parent family, read to your kids, get on the ball.
So he should, you know, think about the millions of Americans who wake up every day, who are living and working hard, sometimes multiple jobs to make ends meet, and they're making the minimum wage or barely a little bit above that. For $5.15 an hour, you have to work a couple jobs, and so does your spouse, and so do some of your kids to be able to pay your rent, pay for your gas, pay for your fuels, and try to figure out how to provide health care. The truth is, workers do work hard, and they struggle, and if they had a better standard of living, if their employers paid them a livable wage and provided the benefits that they should provide, workers could be more involved in their community, could be more involved in their schools, could be more involved with their kids.
And a last question on unionization.
Blame individual people.
If wages are low abroad, how do you keep wages low high here? If they're low in China, if they're low in India, how do you keep them up here? Doesn't the market just inevitably push them down?
Well, actually, that's why our Change the Wind Federation really does believe in a global union movement. We have partnered with unions around the world because we believe that as capital consolidates and as corporations get bigger, that we have to be organizing the companies worldwide, not just in our own countries.
That's why
we're forming coalitions with a number of unions in all parts of the world.
So you say, bring on the labor movement again. We'll be watching. Anna Berger, Secretary Treasurer of the Service Employees International Union, thank you very much for being with us.
It's been great. Thank you.
Doug is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. You know, I look back and I see the right wing, you know, a number of years ago talking about how terrible it was that people were on welfare and were able to, you know, get paid for basically doing no work. But they don't see the same unfairness when it comes to inheritance. And it seems to me that the tax structure, particularly inheritance tax, and increasing that at the higher ends would be one way out of this unequal wealth situation.
We should have asked David K. Johnston about that. Of course, there's been a long, heavy push with a lot of wealth behind it to get rid of the estate tax entirely. David reported just this week that the federal government is moving to eliminate jobs of nearly half the lawyers who audit tax returns of some of the wealthiest Americans around gifts and estates. Do you see a bigger inheritance tax coming, Doug?
Well, I see the inheritance tax going down. That seems to be the trend. I mean, that's what the Bush administration wants to do. And not only inheritance tax, but also other taxes that affect the wealthy, you know, capital gains tax and so forth. And it also seems to me that if we want an even playing field where all people are created equal to the best extent that we can, but we still want to have incentives for people to work hard and
right.
and to be able to get wealthy, you've got the perfect situation where you allow people to build up their wealth, but when they die, that wealth gets taxed back and it goes back to the larger population.
We've got it loud and clear, Doug. We appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, what do you say?
Well, you know, it isn't just the Bush administration that favors this. Among families with income, that is the elimination of the estate tax, among families with incomes of less than $50,000 who want spending on government programs, which I suppose would be liberal, and said inequality had increased, and said that is a bad thing, and said that government policy contributes to inequality, and said that rich people pay less than they should in taxes, 66% of them favored repeal of the estate tax.
Maybe there's a logic there that we should get closer to. Let me bring an economist into this conversation from MIT. Professor David Autor is with us. He specializes in inequality and technological change. David Autor, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
We want to hear your view on the labor market, but let's just jump in right where we are here. Our caller just said, you know, maybe the way to work on this inequality is with the estate tax. Instead of those billions and billions just being passed straight on to another generation, let's reach in, dip into that, spread it around. Is that a solution? Has that got the scale to address what we're up against here, David Autor?
No, I don't have a strong opinion on whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, but I don't think that's a solution. If I can just step back a tiny bit,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to take a little bit of a contrarian perspective, not because I'm not sympathetic to many of these views, but because maybe it'll be helpful.
Great.
So first of all, as Professor Heckman stressed, the labor market is really the most important component of the determination of the distribution of income.
And do you mean the global labor market today, or...?
The wages paid to jobs of workers in the United States.
Okay.
What people are paid is the greatest determinant of how much they ultimately have.
Yep, sure.
Okay. What level of inequality we experience. The labor market in the United States has actually many positive features. And one thing that has not been mentioned is that this rise in inequality, when you talk about the top 10% or top 1%, that's been going on for 25 years at least, started in 1980.
We've said that repeatedly. I guess that's what's got people worried.
But the interesting thing is that at the bottom, inequality has actually been falling, decreasing. Over between 1995 and 2003, high school dropouts and high school graduates saw the fastest wage growth they had seen in 25 years.
But does that decrease the gap? I mean, it's increasing at the top by, you know, 550% over, I forget the period. Is it growing that fast at the bottom? Is that what you're saying?
It's not growing as quickly, but it's growing relative to the median, and it's growing in real terms. In other words, the real purchasing power of less educated workers has been rising considerably during the tight labor markets of the late 90s, and even in the current era, they're growing faster than middle-income wages.
But then what does that mean? You've got this super rich and very affluent at one end and a little bit better off, almost working poor at the other. Is that really an answer to inequality?
Let me first address is why I think this is important. Then I'll tell you whether I'll tell you that I don't think it's an answer to inequality. But let me say something about inequality. First of all, it's not clear what the right level of inequality is. Obviously, we need some inequality to create incentives for people to work, as your last caller stressed. Moreover, at most times and places, survey evidence shows that most people think the level of inequality is a bit higher than it ought to be. It ought to come down a bit. But it's not clear that that answer changes even when inequality rises. In other words, in all times and places, people think it's always a little bit too high. It's not clear what is too much and what is too little.
But though it is clear that it's higher than it's been in a long time, and we're seeing what looks like runoff from that in our political life and in many aspects of our culture.
Well, let me give you one economic indicator that I think is quite important, and that is economic mobility, the likelihood that a person of one income class ends up in another income class.
Right.
You know, by the time he's an adult or the time there's no evidence that economic mobility has fallen over time. So although the level of inequality has risen, the level of churn in the market has risen about proportionally. So it's still as you are still as likely to go from rags to riches or from the lower quartile to the top quartile as you were 30 years ago.
Well, I've read recently that we've got now Scandinavian countries with higher mobility than the United States and far less inequality. What do you make of that?
So actually, this is part of our American mythology is that we are the most mobile society in the world, and that's actually not true. Income mobility data show that we've never had a great deal higher income mobility than other countries. But I guess the point I make, we never were that way, and we're not any less that way now.
If Americans look around today and say, it looks like a problem to us, as you say, it's hard to judge what's the absolute perfect level of inequality, but if it feels wrong, what's your answer? What's a solution? How could we ameliorate it?
Okay, I'm again dodging your question because I want to make two other points, which is something else that the United States has that this may strike you as ironic, but many European countries look to the U.S. labor market as a possible model. Why? Because we have very high employment rates. In other words, many of our workers work. We have women entering the labor force in very large numbers with rising wages, and we have low levels of unemployment. And in fact, your previous speaker, Anna Berger, said, well, we ought to raise the wages in service jobs because they can't be outsourced. And there is a point to that. They can't be outsourced, but they don't actually have to exist. If you look around Western Europe, you'll see there's just many fewer people serving lines, serving meals, driving buses, or buses is actually probably a bad example. But all kinds of service jobs are just kind of missing. And the reason, potentially, at least a likely explanation, is that wages are set at such a high level that those jobs just aren't created.
You've got 1 minute then. What's your answer, Professor?
Okay, well, I have to say, I think, you know, the labor market is very difficult to change. The way to work is to invest in education and to make sure, and particularly instead of focusing on the hyper-rich, to focus on the people near the bottom and make sure they're not at risk of staying there. In other words, what we ought to focus on is skills that allow people to continue to have an opportunity for advancement throughout their lives.
What does that do for the middle class, for the sense of cohesion of a society? You're not saying much about them. They haven't made that progress you're talking about.
They have done. You know, I mean, I would wish it were better, but it's I don't think it's nearly as dire, and especially the trends over the last 10 years haven't been improving. So I don't feel nearly as pessimistic about this as I did in 1989 when I started studying this topic.
Well, we hope you're right, that growth at the bottom keeps up and that we've got something better in the middle as well. And we appreciate your time. David Autor of MIT, thanks for being with us. I'm joined right now by the Reverend Ray Hammond. He's pastor of the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain, Boston, Massachusetts, former surgeon. Reverend Hammond, thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks, Tom.
You see this right down at the grassroots, in the streets, intimately in people's lives. How is it unfolding? Do you see inequality taking a toll?
Well, I think absolutely, in the sense that I find people in the working class, many people in the middle class, certainly people in what we would call the marginal or poor, who are not only, I think, find themselves on the edge, but very concerned about the future for their kids, very disillusioned in many respects about the prospects, both in the sense of whether we as a nation will do what we need to do in order to make opportunity real, and whether in fact we can hold our own in an increasingly competitive global environment. And I find that across a wide range of people, not just the, quote, poor.
We just heard an economist say that at the lower end of income, Americans have actually made some progress in recent years. Do you see that? And do you see the poor feeling like they're bridging that gap in inequality, which is not hard to see these days?
Well, you know, I think from moment to moment, you can certainly, you know, show an uptick here or there. I think the question becomes, looking over 5, 10 years, 15 years, do you see enough sustained progress to really begin to lift people? And all the more so, as I say, the playing field in which they're operating is changing all the time. I mean, I'm one of those people who do believe, in fact, that, you know, as we talk about dealing with this, there are some challenges that we have to put to individuals and families and communities in addressing this. But there's also some significant challenges in terms of the larger society, our government, our public sector. Everybody's got to step up to the plate.
Where do you look for answers there? What kind of policy change do you believe might be helpful?
Well, on the policy side, you know, I think, one, you know, we've got to identify this as a problem. We have to say this is not fully the nation that we want, that we're in this together, that there is a social compact, that we do accept the fact that there are some things that government, as the representative of all of us, has to do. You know, for me, that includes not trying to give large and, I think, disastrous tax cuts while you're prosecuting two wars. That includes getting off of the rhetoric about death taxes. I think it means increasing earned income tax credits so that and getting the information out. That's a responsibility I'm taking in the church, others are, and I think other community organizations. Let people know that there are ladders there for people who are working, and these go back some time. Often people aren't even claiming them. I think we have to look seriously at things like the minimum wage increase. Health insurance. We all understand that this is an economy where jobs are not going to last forever, but people ought to have the confidence that when I move from one job to another, I can carry health insurance that will take care of my family when there's a need. And sure, let's talk about cost containment and let's deal with the prevention aspect, absolutely. But there are some things that we have to do as a nation if we're going to stay competitive. And much more I would say about education and so on. There's work for the individual and the family to do, but there's also work at the sort of the macroeconomic and the policy and societal level.
Reverend Ray Hammond, please stand by. Nat's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Nat. You're on the air. What do you see?
Well, Tom, first of all, I think that, I've enjoyed this discussion. So many wonderful guests. But there are three things that come to mind. The first is this, that we have an extraordinary, I think we have an extraordinary gift in this market economy, which has, in fact, created this vast inequality. But we ought to use that to focus it on education. And I think this, that if we were to target specifically who the next generation will be when we talk about the workforce,
mm-hmm.
which, for example, that means that, for example, under 50, under the age of 5, children under the age of 5 right now are 45% of those children are minority children.
Okay, and that's the future.
Right. 100% of the growth in the workforce between now and 2050 will be minorities. 90% of the growth in the population will be minorities. So that's the first thing, is to target who these people will be. The second thing is this, is to use the market economy itself to create different approaches to education. We've tried it a little bit to use a private sector approach, mm-hmm. but we really haven't done it. And, mm-hmm. and what I see is the opportunity to get government to create incentives where we tap into the creativity that is a part of the American economy.
And your last piece, Nat, give it to us. What's number three?
Well, the third thing is that, it I guess it wraps up into number two, and that is we need to have a creation of thousands of small schools. We have the wrong model for education. If we had thousands of schools that use technology that we have available today that we've never had before, that can personalize education, that can help to address some of the issues on a much mm-hmm. closer basis as opposed to this sort of big government sort of approach, a more personalized approach, our creativity is there. I'm fundamentally optimistic about our ability to do it, but we have to use the thing itself. The market economy itself can solve this problem.
To reach out and make it happen. Nat, we've got it loud and clear, and we appreciate your call. Let me bring an economist in here with us who joined us at the beginning of this week and is here now to talk with us about solutions. Robert Shiller joins us from New Haven, Connecticut, professor of economics at Yale University. He talked about irrational exuberance, wrote about it in the stock market bubble of the late 90s, called it pretty well. He laid out some of this problem for us early in the week, and he's back today. Robert Shiller, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
You've got a solution you're proposing to inequality in this economy. What is it?
Yeah, I first should say this is a new proposal. Nothing that has been brought up on your show yet to this point is new. And I really can't explain it in this time. I'll try to be brief. But this is a proposal that would solve the problem.
Get us right out there on the frontier, then. We're looking for new answers. You're looking
radical,
to the tax system.
No country has done ever what we're proposing. I'm doing this with Len Berman and Jeff Rohalli at the Tax Policy Center.
So bring on the revolution. What's it look like?
Well, the proposal is to index the tax system to inequality.
What does that mean?
That means that instead of setting tax rates, as we now do, we decide on the level of inequality that is our target. And we want some inequality. The target might be today's inequality.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd instruct the tax authorities every year to calculate the tax rates such that after-tax inequality stays the same.
So if inequality was growing, taxes would in that year become more progressive, that would bring it back into line with some baseline.
Automatically. The important thing to say is automatically. We now have a law that takes it out of this class warfare thing. And if inequality gets worse, taxes get more progressive.
You write in your report that this would make the rising tide actually raise all boats, not just the yachts.
Absolutely. What's happening now in the world is people are discovering the power of capitalism. It promotes economic growth, but it also has the risk of increasing inequality. So if we want to pursue that, what we have to do is set up a system so that, as JFK said, the rising tide really does lift all boats.
Now,
we guarantee people that it will.
Is the value of this, then, if the tax became more progressive, you're reducing inequality simply by holding down the after-tax, the sort of take-home pay of the rich, not by raising the bottom?
It would go at all income levels. And so it might involve an increase in the earned incomes tax credit, which was just described.
So it's a kind of redistribution. And the goal here, is it to make the economy work better, or does it take inequality equality as an end in itself, something closer to it?
It sets up a standard. In other words, we don't have any standard. Every year it's just open season for arguments. So we don't have to argue anymore. We can then put in other pro-growth policies without regard for what they'll do for one income group or another, because it will automatically be taken care of by the tax system.
And in your view as an economist, is this in the long run for the health of the democracy or for the health of the American economy, that this tax system would hold inequality, you know, say, this far and no further?
I think it will do both. I think that it's part of our American ideal that we have a system with some inequality, so there's some hope for advancement, but that it doesn't get excessive, and that it will also help spur economic growth. There'll be more of a sense of trust and comfort with our economic system, and that will make for a better economy.
What about James Heckman earlier saying, you know, the real focus here ought to be on education, early childhood education, the family structure, not to break up families? Do you think that would do it, or do we have to get it into this policy level and the tax structure itself?
Well, I think we should do both. A great strength of this country has been its education, and we're relatively speaking falling behind. So that's an old proposal, and I'm with it too.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? Progressive income tax, progressive taxation. If inequality gets worse, tax rates go up for the rich.
It sounds like a great idea, and I'm all for it. The trouble is we have both a politics and a culture of inequality today, and this would essentially be up against both of those. The politics of inequality is indicated, say, in the Congress now, which Republican Congress does not want an increase in the minimum wage and wants to eliminate the estate tax. Well, that's essentially the politics of inequality. That's what they're dedicated to doing. The culture of inequality is that more and more Americans, as I pointed to that data that showed even poor Americans, even Americans who think that the tax, more government spending, we should have more government spending, even they overwhelmingly support the elimination of the estate tax. That's an index of people buying into inequality. Mm-hmm. And inequality establishing itself as a kind of cultural hegemony. These things happen where people, the spontaneous beliefs people have about reality without even challenging them, get filtered down from the dominant classes. And I think that now that's happened.
Let me take a call from Paul. He's in his truck in Baltimore. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been listening, and thank you for taking my call. I've been listening all week, and the thing that bothers me the most is that this is supposed to be government by the people for the people. It isn't anymore. Big business runs this country, not the government. And I think as long as the politicians are taking campaign contributions from these guys, that they're not going to do anything. I don't care how many proposals you've got. I don't care how many ideas you come up with. I think the people of this country should get together and get just right at politicians' faces and say, cut it out.
Paul, we've got it. Our time is short, but you put your finger right on it, and we're grateful for it. Robert Shiller, in brief, do you see a chance in this political environment for a proposal like yours?
Absolutely. I think there can be. In Canada, in 1982, they put in the equalization program that's still there, 25 years later. It can be made to happen as a part of political compromise. It's one of many things, and I think that pro-growth policies are enhanced by that, and Republicans might like that. They might accept it as part of a deal.
Ray Hammond, Reverend Hammond, do you see your flock ready to stand up and say we want to change here, or kind of accepting this in the way that Jack Beatty's describing?
Well, I think people are definitely ready for a change, and I think it's a wonderful proposal. I guess, I keep coming against the fact that God knows we're probably not Canada. You can look at health care and a whole series of other things that whether, in fact, you could get that past the body politic here. It's probably another question. I'd even mention that with Jack, I think some of the issue, even among middle class and poor people, is not so much that they're against perhaps the redress of some of this. It may be that in some cases they don't trust the government to do it. And in some ways, I think the government is going to have to be very clear, and other players. These are the things that we're going to be committing to doing. These are the policies that we're going to pursue. Not just in pursuit of equality or less inequality, but in the pursuit of real opportunity in an increasingly competitive environment globally. Mm. We've all got to get through this together.
Reverend Ray Hammond, pastor of the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain, Boston, Massachusetts. Reverend Hammond, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Robert Shiller, I want to thank you for getting us on to this subject months ago, for joining us at the beginning and again today. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you for addressing this very important topic.
Jack Beatty, great to have you. Thanks so much for being along.
Thank you.
Before we sign off this series, let's listen back to some of the voices we've heard this week speaking to inequality in America.
Well, what we have is an increasing concentration of wealth, not even just among the top 10%, but among the top 1%. And then from there, among the top 0.1%. And from there, among the top 0.01%. So it's not merely a matter of the rich and the poor. It's becoming a nation in which it's a matter of the ultra rich and everyone else.
Do you feel that you're able to take full part in the life of this country, the life of this democracy? Is it open to you?
Right now, no. I feel completely shut out. It's very frustrating. It's hard to live day in and day out knowing that I've got a mountain of bills that I can't even make a dent on.
And yet, I think our ambivalence stems from the question as to what the ideal model of success is. Is it a Warren Buffett, who, despite being the second wealthiest person in the world, lives in a house he bought in 1958 for $31,000? Mm-hmm. Or is it Donald Trump?
At 60 years old, I got to tell you something. I have never been more afraid for our nation. I feel this nation viscerally in my genes and in my blood. And I must tell you, what we got going here is we have a feudal society developing with the one half of 1%, the royalty, folks that are making a paltry $200,000 or $300,000 a year as the vassal, and then we have the rest of us, the serfs.
You know, I have to so heartily disagree. I actually celebrate our unequal playing field. You know, in America, the great thing about this country is opportunity.
You hear he's saying, go, Bill Gates, go.
The question is, what about Bill Gates' kids? They're not going to start where Bill did. And I think that's the question about inequality. When does inequality calcify? When does it become hereditary? When does it become effectively an aristocracy? That's the great danger.
And we're seeing more and more of a seepage of the inequality of income and wealth into our political system, where it's illegitimate, quite frankly.
I understand that I'm not going to make millions, and I'm not really looking to make millions. I'm just looking to make ends meet.
We have had now a long history of very limited participation in the benefits of our growth. I think it's a very serious issue, and I think it's going to lead, as it should lead, to a very serious debate in the time ahead.
Listeners, thanks for all your phone calls and emails in response to this week's series. The series was produced by Matt Lieber, and a special thanks to Matt. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.